This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome, everyone, to our Cognitive Health and Resilience panel. This is a topic that is both deeply personal and profoundly special. As our population ages, more and more people are touched by memory decline, dementia, and other cognitive challenges of sustaining attention and adaptability. So along these challenges, we also seek remarkable examples of resilience. These are individuals who are going to maintain cognitive flexibility, sharpness, purpose for life, and creativity. So the central question before us is, what enables the brain, the body, the mind to remain resilient across a lifespan? And equally important, how can we promote resilience for everyone, not just lucky few? Well, luckily for us, we have foremost experts in this space to join us on the stage, Dr. Aaron Sunderman, Dr. Ann Moore, and our community member, Dr. Carolyn Dunmore. So my name is Fadil Zidan, and I'm also a neuroscientist here at UC San Diego, and I study the effects of mindfulness meditation and psychedelics on resilience and the ability of our brain to demonstrate resilience and the way that it can change as a function of mental training. So why don't we get a little intro from our panelists, starting with Dr. Sunderman.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here and to be having this conversation with you all. I am an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSD. I do research in Alzheimer's disease. And when we think about Alzheimer's disease and dementia, we can often feel hopeless, as if it's an inevitable part of aging for some of us. But the research tells us a different story. So the encouraging news is the research suggests that there actually are things that we can do to build resilience in our brain that can then reduce our risk of dementia or even delay the onset of it by some years. One of the most compelling pieces of evidence for this comes from the Lancet Commission on Dementia Prevention. So their analysis of over a million people over decades of research found that 45% of dementia cases can potentially be prevented by addressing lifestyle factors or modifiable health factors. So this means that almost half of dementia cases are not inevitable, and in fact, they are within our power of influence. So that's great news. So what are these factors? So, well, I'm going to talk about a few that have some of the strongest evidence. And you've heard all these before. So, but that's no surprise because these things contribute to cognitive resilience, mental health resilience, physical resilience. It's all interconnected. Physical activity is probably one of our most powerful tools. If someone asked me, what can I do to reduce my risk of dementia, if there's just one thing, I would say physical activity. Even moderate activity. So brisk walking for 150 minutes a week reduces dementia risk by 20 to 30%. And the benefits of physical activity are really multifold. So there's the heart-brain connection. So physical activity, it promotes blood flow to the brain, which gives the brain energy, and it helps to promote new brain connections. It also reduces risk of hypertension and diabetes, which are very strong risk factors for dementia. And it helps to relieve anxiety, depression, and inflammation. All these help to support brain health. And then there's social engagement, which we've definitely heard about. So social isolation in studies is actually associated with smaller brain region sizes. And we're talking about centers responsible for memory and thinking. So social engagement is really, really a critical piece. So doing things like this, volunteering, joining community groups are not just enjoyable, they're protective. Age-related hearing loss is one of the strongest risk factors for dementia. We are not sure why. It could be that it contributes to social isolation. It could also be that there is reduced stimulation to the auditory cortex, which is actually housed next, right near our memory center of our brain. We're not sure. But regardless of why, the good news is that it's one of the most modifiable risk factors with hearing aids. Lifelong learning and mental stimulation, we've heard a lot about that. People with higher levels of education have lower levels of dementia, but it's never too late. You know, doing things even in late life, learning new skills, new hobbies, reading, all those things can help protect your brain. Now, what if we combined all these protective factors together? Could we create a really effective dementia risk prevention strategy? The U.S. POINTER trial, it was a nationwide study, was designed to address just this question. This was a clinical trial where older adults at higher risk for dementia were randomly assigned to either a structured and monitored lifestyle intervention program that addressed exercise, diet, cognitive training, just overall health monitoring, or a self-guided intervention that also addressed all these domains, but was self-guided. And this went on for 2 years. Well, their highly anticipated results were just released last July. The good news is that in both groups, cognitive function improved. And this is impressive because we expect some degree of decline in our cognitive function just naturally with age. So not only did the people in this trial not decline at all, but they actually improved. And it was the people in the structured, monitored group that actually improved great, even more so. So this is great. So the message I want to leave you with is one of empowerment. Of course, we can't change our age or our genes, but we can certainly build resilience in the brain to help ward off age-related brain changes and dementia brain changes. These are no guarantees, but if we just do small and consistent changes across these domains, we certainly can put the odds in our favor. So thank you.
Dr. Moore?
Yeah, thank you for that, Aaron. That was really great. Hello, good afternoon. I'm Rayanne Moore. I'm a professor of psychiatry at UCSD. I'm a clinical neuropsychologist by training. And my research studies, you know, cognitive aging and trying to identify risk for cognitive decline early on in a diverse range of populations. So people at risk for Alzheimer's disease, also people with serious mental illness. And more recently, I've also been working with cancer survivors. And Aaron and I were kind of chatting about what we were going to talk about today, and I decided to give you a top 10 list of some things you can actually do to help compensate for some brain changes that affect all of us as we age. And I also thought about memorizing them, but one of the tips is to write it down. So I have my notes right here. So if you have paper and a pen, get that out. And I'm going to go over 10 things that that we teach when we do cognitive rehabilitation strategies to folks that are just things you probably already know, but good reminders and can really help us make these little changes in addition to the things Aaron was talking about, physical activity, social interaction, intellectually stimulating activities. These are also tips you can do in your daily life to help with cognitive resilience and reserve. So the first one is focused on processing speed. Processing speed is, you know, how we're able to integrate the information around us. And it does slow in normal aging. It's the one cognitive domain we just definitively see slowing throughout the lifespan. So it just takes us longer to process information as we get older. But we're wiser, so slower and wiser is the name of the game. So the first tip I already mentioned, get information in writing, take notes, write things down. Number two, allow yourself extra time to complete tasks. If you're working for a deadline, you may need to begin sooner than you did when you were younger, and that's okay. Plan for extra time and also plan for breaks. It's recommended to give yourself brain breaks, ideally, you know, a minute to 5 minutes every half hour or so. I know sometimes when we're working for big deadlines, that can be really tough, but even just 5 minutes every hour can really just give your brain that refresh it needs. And during that brain break, it can be getting up and going for a walk, having a snack, doing a little bit of mindfulness or deep breathing, just turning away from a screen or the activity that you're doing, and letting your brain have that time to rest. Number three, be patient with yourself. You will get there. It just might take you a little bit longer, and that's okay. Number four, increase the time you take between activities. So sometimes, especially when we're, you know, in our 20s and 30s, we kind of plan our days back to back to back to back with activities. As we get older, it just gets harder for the brain to keep up with that. So if you know you're going to have a really busy day, you have a doctor's appointment in the morning, and then you have lunch with a friend, and then you have yoga in the afternoon, and then maybe you have a friend's birthday party that evening, give yourself time to rest your brain the next day. Maybe plan to take the next day off and just plan for those extended breaks the busier you are. Number five, I'm going to move on to some memory tips. The number one memory question people tend to ask is about remembering names. And that is something that we all can struggle with. So one thing that can be really helpful is trying verbal or visual associations that can make the names more meaningful. So I'm just going to pick on you in the front row. What's your name? Mari. So Mari, some visual associations I would use, has a beautiful yellow top on, has short gray hair, and has a really nice smile. And those are visual associations I would put together with Mari. So the next time I see her, would help me remember her name. You also want to say the name at least three times in conversation. So Mari, thank you for volunteering to be my example today. Next is establishing routines to help you limit how much you need to remember. Routines are key to preserving our brain health. You know, because for each thing you have to remember in your brain, it gets so full and it's just harder than as new things come in and you have so many competing things. So as much as you can offload having to remember things by establishing routines, it can be incredibly helpful. And there's a ton of research just on the cognitive benefits of routines. Number seven, put important things away in a designated space. So always have a home for your most important items, phone, keys, wallet, medications. Put them in the same place every time. That's building that routine. That's taking that out of your working memory and freeing up that space. Also use memory aids, calendars, day planners, memory books, you know, are your best friend. That's also part of just getting it out of your working memory there and into a space. So you don't have to try to remember. Something people often struggle with is what we call prospective memory. And that's the ability to remember things happening in the future. So when was that doctor's appointment I had? My husband's the worst. Like first thing in the morning every day, he's like, okay, so what's on the schedule today? And when was that thing we had tomorrow? And what's the thing on the weekend? And I'm like, it's on the calendar. Just go look on the calendar. That's what it's for. Number nine, and this one has to do with our ability to have selective attention or, you know, help with filtering out extraneous information, which can be more challenging sometimes as we age, and especially if we're dealing with things like hearing loss. So minimize external distractions as much as you can. You know, if you're having a conversation with someone and you find you're just getting really distracted by everything that's going on around you, ask to move to a quieter place. If you're having a phone call and, you know, the dog's barking and, you know, your kids are in the background making noise or whatever it may be, move to a different space. Maximize your environment to optimize your cognitive performance. And the last tip I have is ask for help. So it's always okay to ask for help. You don't have to remember to do everything on your own. And I'll stop there and pass it along to Caroline.
Okay, my name is Caroline Dunmore, and I've been a participant with the Tau study and on Alzheimer's. And it was interesting because coming from a background of being in the foster care system and growing up in the foster care system, and I was blessed to have two homes. I'm going to try to do this very quickly. Okay. And so in my second home, you know, was always the pressure of, you know, you got to remember this, you got to remember that. They'd send me to the store to get stuff, and I'd come and say, I forgot. So I've noticed in school I was having difficulties with spelling words. So that means I've got to put in more effort to study harder because I notice I'm not recalling what I'm studying. Okay. We had the test, and one of the young ladies, bless her heart, and she was giving me the words and everything, and I went and I couldn't repeat all of them. I couldn't repeat them. And bless her little heart, and I could just see her out the side of my eyes. She was so uncomfortable. But this was her first time being in the situation of testing. So she was shadowing. And I felt so bad for her because I knew where I was. I knew where I was, and I knew where I had come from to be where I am today. So there are times when I will play off not remembering anything. What? Who? I don't know. Refresh my memory. Okay. Oh, yes, I do remember. I do remember. But the things that I do to help me to achieve to where I am today is that I have to write it down. I have to have a routine. And I have to be honest with myself. If I'm not honest with nobody else, I'm going to be honest with myself. And I love me more than anything. You can tell me that, but I love me more than anything. Okay, so therefore, I'm going to help whomever needs to be helped. What they have all brought all to you all tonight is today is very important. I watched my foster mom with dementia. So I understood what was going to be. So therefore, I did all the research I could do to help me to maintain me and anybody else that I need that I come in contact with. Resilience, I give that all to God because He is my source. I've learned how to forgive people that have done some ugly things. That is what has been keeping me young, is to release that stress. When I find that stress, you're stressing me in my life, I cut you out. I cut you out. I drop you like a hot potato. Okay? I love peace, and we'll hurt you about some peace. But I do. I honestly do believe that all this has been a help. This is my first time being here. I hope it won't be my last. I'm looking forward to helping those that understand that even though we have our shortcomings, we may not always remember. Be patient with yourself. Be patient with yourself. More than anything, give yourself some grace and love yourself. And I don't know, is there anything else you want me to say?
Oh, yeah, there is, but... Be careful what you ask for. Thank you so much to our panelists. It was really insightful. What I'm seeing is this kind of common theme across not only this panel, but the whole day, about being patient with ourselves and cultivating awareness to kind of be present-centered, finding ways to regulate our emotions and the stressors that arise on our day-to-day life. And what we've seen in our laboratory is that we can actually train the mind in many different ways to offset some of the age-related deficits that may just naturally occur. And what we're seeing is that you don't necessarily have to be a Buddhist monk or an expert, that in fact, if you just parcel out 5 to 10 minutes a day to sit on your breathing, focus on your breath, to give yourself a break, that can actually enhance cognitive resilience, which is increasing the ability for your memory to work, for your attentional speed to go faster, and your ability to process things in real time, which we believe has this kind of domino effect on our overall physical and psychological health that's mediated, that's facilitated through improvements in your cognition. So I want to see, are there other tools that your research has shown us, whether it's technology, whether it's appreciating differences in sex differences, on how cognitive processes are manifested, that can help inform us in appreciating what cognitive resilience looks like?
Great question. So I study sex differences, the influence of sex in Alzheimer's disease. Why do women represent 2/3 of Alzheimer's cases? I'm dedicated to trying to figure out why. One line of my research is very focused on sex differences in cognitive abilities throughout the lifespan and how that contributes to detection of Alzheimer's disease later in life. Women tend to have an advantage in verbal memory. So memory for words, stories, things like that. Men have their advantages too. They tend to do better with visuospatial function. This is, of course, averages. There's certainly a lot of women out there who excel in visuospatial. It's not me. But these are all just averages. So one thing that my work focuses on is how does that verbal, because verbal memory is one of the domains that is the first to decline in Alzheimer's disease, and one of the domains with the most prominent declines, most of our tests that to detect early stage Alzheimer's disease are verbal memory tests. So how does the female advantage in verbal memory affect our ability to detect Alzheimer's disease in women? Because a lot of these tests don't adjust. They might adjust for your age or your years of education, but unfortunately, some of them don't adjust for sex. So a lot of my research is suggesting that women may be more advanced and their brain changes when they actually become when they show enough cognitive symptoms to be diagnosed with early stage Alzheimer's disease. So that is just one example of how cognitive abilities throughout your life can influence, later life detection methods and your risk.
So just really quick. So basically, because females are more advanced than males, I think you used those words.
She definitely used those words, yes.
That it might be harder to diagnose early onset dementia in females versus males because of the big difference. So are there any strategies or things that females could look out for to better diagnose, better help kind of grab these symptoms as they arise from your work?
You know, I would say be attuned to yourself. Be perceptive. We know when we decline more so than anyone else. And, you know, be an advocate for yourself. When you go to the doctor and, you know, you explain what you're feeling, what you're noticing, be an advocate for yourself. You know, even if, a cognitive test says, oh, no, you're still in the normal range, explain what you're experiencing. And don't just take that as this is the end, no more. Really advocate for yourself and what you are experiencing, I would say.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. Dr. Moore, any technologies out there, any kind of interventions that you've found to be uniquely efficacious?
So a lot of the work we do is what we call digital phenotyping, which is using technology we have in our everyday life, so our smartphones, wrist wearables like our Apple Watches and Fitbits, to see if it can help us better understand our brain health. And in one of our ongoing studies, we're doing what we call passive digital phenotyping, which means we don't have to, the participant doesn't have to do anything. They just have to install some phones on or some apps on their phone, and they have to wear a Fitbit we give them, and then we just track their behaviors. We track where they go throughout the day, how many steps they take, how they sleep, their screen time uses, and seeing if this type of data can help us identify early risk for Alzheimer's disease. And some of the newer research or newer analyses we've been doing, we've finally finished enrollment in the study and started to look at the data and seen that based on GPS data from the smartphone, that the further people travel throughout the day is related to less risk for Alzheimer's disease. People who are staying home more and have just a smaller footprint in their daily life have higher risk. And it makes sense. And it's nice when the data backs up what we're finding. So in other research, what we've found is that it's a cumulative effect of engagement in physical activity, engagement in social interactions, and engagements of cognitively stimulating activities every day that really puts you at highest risk, not risk, lack of risk for cognitive decline, puts you in the best position. So all of these things in and of themselves are great, but if you cumulatively are doing a little bit of all of these things every day, it's really been found to be the most beneficial.
Wow, that's really fascinating, which makes me look at my commute to La Jolla much differently. And maybe I should move to Imperial Beach, I guess, or that's really remarkable. I never heard that before. Thank you for that insight. So, you know, Carolyn, I really appreciate your take on prayer and your, you know, your community, your church community, on how that has kind of manifested in your eyes as a form of resilience. But I was wondering if you could share with us other habits, exercises, social activities that you participate in that you have felt have impacted or enhanced your cognitive resilience.
I exercise 2 days a week. I take the stairs every day. I keep myself active. If you move, you're not going to lose it. But if you don't move, you're going to lose it all. Seriously. I started out doing crossword puzzles to keep my mind stimulated, reading the dictionary as a little girl because I'm fascinated with words. These are the kind of things that I kind of work towards, but my own personal relationship with God is a totally different thing. Yes, I'm active in my church. I go to church every Sunday. I'm part of the, I'm the head for the hospitality committee where I live. I came in and they immediately put me to work as the tennis association's secretary. Now I am the president of the tenant association. Nobody wanted the job. So they elected me. So I keep busy.
Yeah, I sounds like it. So, and I'm seeing this common theme also about this principle of you use it or you lose it. And I think, you know, from the work that we've done, we scan people's brains, especially older adults that have chronic pain, and we see that their brains are total they're different. I mean, they're different. If you know, you have chronic pain, and you have if you have chronic pain, you likely have other what we call comorbidities like depression, anxiety, and perhaps a sedentary lifestyle because you can't move so much. But what we also find is that just 4 days of mental training, mindfulness-based mental training, can change stabilized pathways in the brain that are predictive of feeling less pain. And it's unique in the way that mindfulness works is that it's not necessarily taking the pain away, but rather it's just changing the relationship that you have with your pain.
Yes.
Where you can kind of disentangle the idea that this is my pain or that my identity makes up this pain. My identity makes up this kind of
what my physician called a chronic disease and whatnot. And so I think what we're seeing are some of these skills that we're talking about are skills that we can harness throughout an entire lifetime, but they seem to be uniquely efficacious at an older age. And some of the work that we're seeing across a lot of laboratories at UCSD and in the world is that you don't need years of training to reap the benefits, that even one session can make you feel better. And so it accumulates because there's this idea that the state of feeling better with more training will eventually develop into a trait. It becomes your temperament. And that's really a reflection of the malleability of the human condition and how much change, which is inevitable in our lives, can be facilitated with intention. So cognitive resilience clearly has biological, psychological, and social dimensions. But if you all had to highlight one key factor, whether it's hormones or technology or meditation or anything else that you believe holds promise for promoting resilience and healthy aging, what would it be and why? And if you feel the liberty to speak from a personal standpoint, by all means, or you can cite your own research as well.
Exercise. The research consistently shows, as Dr. Sunderman was mentioning, exercise is the number one thing to promote brain health.
And that's, I know that it might seem counterintuitive, like, but that helps with my maintaining my weight and my musculature, but it's just blood flow to the brain, and it's just nourishing your synapses and giving them the nutrients it needs to build new synapses. But I'd also just like to highlight learning new skills, super important. Just trying new things, anything to make the brain create new synapses. Don't just repeat and do the same thing you do all the time. Try to do something novel that kind of leads to new brain connections. I think that is very important.
I guess I would also say, because we haven't talked about mental health yet, but depression and anxiety are not a part of normal aging and can significantly impact how our brain functions, especially our memory, our ability to pay attention, our ability to process information. The good news is there, depression and anxiety and other mental health symptoms are treatable. So if you are experiencing those symptoms, don't brush them off as part of normal aging, but seek help for that, because if you get this mental health symptoms improved, then you'll notice a positive improvement on your brain health as well.
Well said. Do you want to add anything, Carolyn?
Not really.
Okay. I love it. Awareness. Cultivating awareness. Do we have questions that
Yes. Okay. So we'll be collecting some cards right now, but I'll kick us off with some. Okay. So people want to know about the factors that have been attributed to the higher rates of Alzheimer's in women. Can one of you speak to that?
Yes. There's a few. So one thing that people always ask me is it because women tend to live longer? So the longer lifespan means they're at an older age for longer, and guess what? Older age is the strongest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. So is it that? Well, we have done studies that statistically adjust for this phenomenon, and we find it contributes somewhat, but not all. So there's definitely other factors at play. And there's a lot of research into, so basically what that does, this sex difference, it gives us a clue, right? It gives us a clue that there are sex disparate factors at play in the disease. And if we study these factors, it's kind of like a window into the disease etiology for all. So those sex disparate factors that we've been looking at are definitely sex hormones, and the fact that females experience menopause, that is a unique experience to females. Men have this nice gradual decline of testosterone that's pretty much symptom-free. It is so not fair. Women experience menopause, and the research suggests that there's actually brain changes that occur with menopause, one of the big ones being how the brain utilizes energy. There are serious changes in that. In fact, there was a speaker earlier today that focused on ketone bodies. And what happens is the brain energy source switches from glucose more so to ketone bodies. What else? There is also a lot of research on sex chromosomes. So women have two X, this is biology refresher, two X chromosomes in women. Men have X and a Y chromosome. So because there's the same genes on both X chromosomes, what females experience is a random X chromosome inactivation. So one of your X chromosome is inactivated randomly, and that is to stop overexpression of these genes because we don't need two times of that. Well, there's a lot of times our chromosomes will escape what we call inactivation escape, which means that we do have a double dose of these gene products. And there's some research coming out that some of these gene products are associated with things like inflammation and might be contributing to an Alzheimer's disease risk. So those two examples of some research that's going on trying to understand why women have a higher risk.
Great, thank you. Here's a great question. How does cognitive resilience correlate with traumatic and adverse life events?
This isn't my area of expertise per se, but I would imagine that a traumatic event would be associated with weaker cognitive resilience. Or as Dr. Newman said, which I like this idea that the antithesis of resilience is frailty. And so probably cognitive frailty is a function of higher trauma. But there is this construct in psychology that's well established called post-traumatic growth. And it's the ability from somebody to, quote unquote, recover from a traumatic event in a way that isn't debilitating to their well-being. And I would imagine that the mediator of that, the reason that that occurs, is through enhanced cognitive resilience. So perhaps using different tools like cognitive strategies, physical exercise, diet that's anti-inflammatory, a positive social network, staying active, doing novel things, this kind of potpourri of things that are available to us can kind of help offset that relationship between weakened cognitive resilience and trauma. The panelists agree with everything I just said.
Yes. There was a lot of nodding
speechless.
There. Okay.
So...
Fantastic. Yeah, that means you answered it well. Okay, what is the data or the research on brain training programs? Effective, not effective, certain programs better than others?
It's mixed. There's a couple different kinds of brain training programs. There's brain training programs that are restorative brain training programs. Those are things like Luminosity is one, the Achilles. I don't remember the rest of the name of Achilles, but it's training you on one specific cognitive mechanism. So like processing speed, for example, because you're going to be doing one task over and over and over and over and over and over and over again to kind of retrain those neurons to improve at that task. The evidence shows it's really good at improving your ability to do that task, but it's weaker when you look at translation of those improvements to functioning in your everyday life. There's another type of cognitive training called compensatory cognitive training, which is based on kind of some of the tips I gave you earlier, where you find assistance and aids and ways to help you not have to rely on your brain for everything, like writing it down, using calendars, things like that. And the evidence is pretty strong for compensatory cognitive training. There is some work, and we're doing a study right now where we're doing a hybrid approach of both restorative and compensatory training. So far, it's looking pretty good, but that's an ongoing clinical trial. So come back next year and I'll give you the results.
Well, I'm glad you went first because You said it better than I did. I was going to comment on bringing games like Lumosity. Be cautious of their claims. Lumosity actually was hit with a $2 million lawsuit from the FDA as to false claims for reducing your risk of dementia. So they don't hurt, certainly, but as Dr. Moore said, they improve your ability to do that particular task, and they can be fun. So there's that. But just take, you know, be cautious when you hear claims.
And I would say video games are more fun, right? Or the Wordle.
Okay, great. So is there research either on alcohol and drug use and cognitive resilience, or either past alcohol and drug use, so like in your 20s and 30s, or current alcohol and drug use on cognitive resilience? What does the research say on this?
I hope alcohol use in your 20s doesn't affect the... Dear Lord.
A lot of people in trouble if that's the case.
I would... So in older adults, this is inconsistent, but there is some evidence that moderate alcohol use can actually be beneficial for the brain. Heavy alcohol use is consistently associated with poor cognitive function and greater risk. But there is some evidence that, you know, maybe a glass of red wine a day. And who knows, maybe that's because... that is fosters social connection, and people who drink tend to be with others. And so that could be a factor in that association. But I don't know about younger alcohol use, but definitely the heavy alcohol use at any point in life is certainly not advisable and ill protective.
I was just going to say, yeah, I'm not familiar with the research on early use either, but research is, you know, more and more it is coming out that any alcohol use is not good for you right now. Take that for what it is. You know, also if you look at the populations in the world where there's the most successful agers and the people who live to be the oldest, it's places like, you know, this island, I think it's this island in Greece. Am I getting that correct? Where it has the most centenarians in the world. And these people drink alcohol every day and, you know, eat a Mediterranean diet. So I think there's still a lot unknown about the effects of alcohol, but, you know, moderation, as Aaron said, is important.
I think that's exactly what I was going to say. I think that might be culturally relative, because it seems that the more alcohol and carbohydrates Italians eat, the longer they live. I'm not sure how that works, but Their diets aren't processed, but they, you know, there's a bottle of wine at lunch, and lunch is 3 hours long. I have no idea how anyone gets work done, but perhaps that's the key there. Although drugs, you know, that's a massive category, I would imagine. So if you're sharing needles and doing heroin a lot every day, or things like that, you're probably going to be very low on the cognitive resilience side. So just throwing that in the dark. I'm guessing. So, but it's a great question, and I think we're seeing, yes, that there are some detriments, but the jury's still out. And I think it's culturally relative, honestly. Why are you drinking, right? That's probably an important question.
Well, thank you all so much for such a fantastic panel. So appreciate all your time. You guys were great.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.